Tonight we want to talk about the wheat and the tares. And of course, we're talking about parables. We're studying through the parables. We started this study last Sunday morning when we spoke of the parable of the sower, or the parable of the souls, whatever you want to call that. And tonight we want to talk about the parable of the wheat and the tares. I told Kenny over lunch today that the parable of the wheat and the tares is probably, decidedly, one of the most difficult parables of them all to understand. You really get into digging in and studying this thing, it can become difficult. And it's very ironic because, as we pointed out, it's one of the two parables that Jesus actually gives the explanation to. And as you'll see in my lesson, I think that's part of the problem. There are people who examine the parable very closely. They pick it to death, and then they make certain applications while ignoring what the Lord said in the explanation. And I think many of the misunderstandings that are brought about in talking about this parable can be overcome by simply looking at the facts. And so as we consider the parable of the wheat and the tares, and really, as anybody considers this parable, there are three things that must be done. Number one, one must define the elements of the parable. Define the elements. And we get them right there in the parable. For example, turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 13. If you hadn't done so already, place your bookmark there. Jesus tells the parable itself in verses 24 to 30. When he says another parable, he put forth of them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the grain had sprouted and produced a crop, then the tares also appeared. So the servants of the owner came and said to him, 'Sir, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' And the servants said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' But he said, 'No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather together the tares and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Now, if you drop down a few verses, you'll see in verses 36 to 43 the explanation of this parable that Jesus gives. Let's read that very quickly. Verse 36, "Then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house, and his disciples came to him, saying, 'Explain to us the parable of the tares in the field.' And he answered and said to them, 'He who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear.'" Now, if you notice here, Jesus actually defined the elements of the parable, didn't he? I mean, he just come right out and told us. It's like he gave us a lexicon here. He says, the sower is the Son of Man. That's Jesus. The sower is Jesus. In this parable, that's the sower. Now, you remember in our last parable we looked at last week that anyone who is going forth with the gospel of Christ was the sower in that story. And really, let me just caution you here, if you try to make a lot of comparisons with this parable and the previous parable, you're going to get very confused because there are some elements that are the same in both parables, but really have different applications than in the other parable. So you really got to be careful there. The field. Now, the field here, Jesus said, is the world. That's what he said. I didn't say it. Jesus said the field is the world. The good seed represents the sons of the kingdom. Can we say Christians? I think so. So the good seed represents the children of God. The bad seed represents the sons of the wicked one, those who are disobedient to the gospel. The enemy, Jesus said, represents the devil. The harvest represents the end of the age. And the reapers in this story represents the angels. Now, I want to point something out here, and we're going to get back to this. Jesus did not say what the servants represented. Don't forget that. That's important. He didn't, did he? He did not say what the servants represented. And so when considering this parable, we really must define the elements. Number two, it would help us out a lot to discuss the explanations. And what I mean here is the explanations that men give, because I assure you, I have a whole stack of books specially written on the parables in my library, and I've got another stack a lot higher of commentaries, different ones from different writers on the book of Matthew, and I've read every one of them. And I'm going to tell you what, there are really two prevailing views out there, and when it gets right down to it, I'm not sure if I really agree with either one of them. I think I do agree with one on a general level, but when it gets down to specifics, I was scratching my head and having a little bit of disagreement. For example, there are some who view the field as the church. In this parable, the field that the seed has been sown in, that's the church to them. They say that's the church. They get this from verse 41. There, when Jesus is explaining the parable, he said, "The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness." You see that? And so when the reaper come, they're gathering, whoever they're gathering them out of the kingdom. Now, those who believe that the field is the church will also say about verse 29. And verse 29 really is a controversial passage between the two views. But he said to them, "An enemy has done this." The servant said to him, "Do you want us to go then to go and gather them up?" But he said, "No, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them." And so there are some in denominationalism who's viewing this as the church, who will say something against church discipline, and that we shouldn't practice church discipline. Just leave them alone and let them grow up together in the field. And so this to them is a prohibition of church discipline. There are others who say that this is the whole world who will condemn the idea of judging anybody. You ever hear that in the denominational world? You're never supposed to judge anybody. And yet Jesus commanded, judge righteous judgment. Certain types of judgment certainly are condemned, but not all judgment. And so there are some who view the field as the church, and then there are others who view the field as the whole world. Now here's how their arguments go. Number one, and this is the clincher, I think. We'll get to that passage in a moment. This is what they say. Jesus said the field is the world. That's pretty strong, isn't it? Now, as far as I'm concerned, that's all I need. That ends the argument. Remember we looked at it? Jesus said the field is the world, all humanity. And then they explain verse 41 when it talks about the reapers gathering out of the kingdom and separating out of the kingdom. They claim, and I tend to agree with this particular understanding, that the kingdom there, as it is being used, is speaking of the kingdom in its general sense to mean God's rule over all men. For example, in the book of 1 Chronicles, we see this usage. 1 Chronicles, and there are other passages we could turn to, but as I've always said, it just takes one passage to prove a point. But 1 Chronicles chapter 29 and verses 11 and 12. And I know 1 Chronicles is in the Old Testament, but sometimes it takes me a while to get there. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11 and 12 says, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power, and the glory, the victory, and the majesty, for all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head over all." Didn't Daniel talk about how God rules in all the kingdoms of the earth? Doesn't Romans 13 tell us that God appoints the governing authorities no matter what kingdom it is? I mean, ultimately, God rules in this world, period. And sometimes the word kingdom is used in that generic sense to denote that. And so since Jesus said the field is the world, the only conclusion I can come to is that when kingdom is being mentioned here, it's talking about kingdom in the general sense of the usage of the term. Now, those who argue that the field is the whole world, and remember, I agree with that, but I don't agree with everything they argue from the parable. One argument that they make is that if the kingdom is talking about the church, Jesus said the field is the world. Kingdom is speaking in a general sense. And if it's talking about the church, then it makes verses 29 and 30 contradict Matthew 18, verses 15 to 17. You know what's in that passage? When Jesus talked about if your brother sins against you, go to him, you and him alone, and try to resolve it. If he won't hear you, go get a couple of witnesses and talk to him. If he won't hear them, tell it to the church. If he won't hear the church, then he shall be unto you like a heathen and a tax collector. Now that's what Matthew 18, verses 15 to 17 teach. But then they take the application of Matthew 13, verse 29, where Jesus said, leave them alone. Let them grow up together. Don't go in and uproot them. Don't go in and rip out those tares. Just let them stay together. And so you see, if this is talking about the church, the argument is made that Jesus argues here that you ought to just leave the ones who sin in the church alone. Let them all grow up together. See that? But then that contradicts what the Lord taught in Matthew 18, 15 to 17 when it says you ought to deal with those who sin and will not repent. So you have a contradiction. Not to mention 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 to 8, when Paul talked about when you're gathered together, deliver such a one to Satan. Remember that? For the destruction of the flesh, so his soul may be saved. And then he says in that passage, a little leaven, leaven's the whole lump. Well, if you understand what these say about this passage in Matthew 13, just leave them alone and let them grow up in the church. Well, that's like saying just leave the leaven in there. But Paul said, purge out the leaven. So you see, that cannot be the understanding of verse 29. As one writer said, to make the field the church is to put the children of the devil in the kingdom. And then he says, while they may enjoy the fellowship of a local church, they haven't figured out his sin. He's a hypocrite. He's keeping it hidden from them. God knows that he's a sinner, and they are not in a real sense in the kingdom in any sense. And so I believe that the field is not the church. I believe that, as Jesus said, the field is the world. What is a parable? Well, we need to understand a very important rule about the parable, the parables. And matter of fact, when we're dealing with any type of symbolic language, now the parables are symbolic language. Okay, we need to understand that. Most of the time, parables are in the form of what we would call similes. Now, there are metaphors and there are similes, and there's other type. A metaphor is when the thing being compared is said to be the actual thing. Remember, in Matthew chapter 5, 13 to 16, Jesus said about believers, you are the salt. And we know we're not literally salt. And so it's a metaphor. You are the salt of the world or the earth. You are the light of the world. We're not literally lights, not in the physical sense. And so we know that Jesus is using a metaphor there. But when it's a simile, the same concept is being taught, except it doesn't come out and say, you are the light, but it would say, you are like a light. You are likened to a light. That would be a simile. But both are symbolic language. And such as is in many of the parables, Jesus would say, the kingdom of heaven is like, or likened to. So very similar to a simile. The parables of Jesus, for the most part, are to be approached in the same way we would approach the book of Revelation, for example. Not every little thing, every little word, every little statement is meant to have a significant meaning, but you look at the whole parable as a picture, and the parts are to be taken as a whole in order to get the lesson that the Lord is trying to teach. This is a problem premillennialists make with the book of Revelation and other people. They want to go in there and they want to find some kind of significant meaning for every little word. Some kind of meaning there. Some kind of meaning there. When really, as a whole, the book of Revelation is meant to read the whole section and kind of get the big picture. And all the descriptive details are just that. They're just incidentals. They're just descriptive details in order to try to fill in the entire picture without every little statement or word having some sort of great spiritual meaning. That is a misunderstanding of the book of Revelation. That is a false way to approach the book of Revelation. And the same is true with the parables of Jesus. For example, in Luke chapter 18 in verses 1 to 8, do you remember the parable that is there? The parable of the persistent widow. Has this parable ever given anybody any problems about the character of God? You ever scratch your head here and say, is God like that? Because it says here, in verse 2 of Luke 18, there was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God nor regard man. You're going to find as you read this parable that that judge represents God. In the parable, that judge represents God. Now there was a widow in that city, and she came to him saying, "Get justice for me from my adversary." Now remember in verse 1, he's teaching men that they always ought to pray. And so in the parable, the judge represents God. This widow represents the follower of God. And so she comes to him and says, "Get justice for me from my adversary." And he would not for a while, but afterwards he said within himself, "Though I do not fear God nor regard man," can you imagine God saying such a thing? "Yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me." Now, do you think that's how God feels about his children? Or you think God really does care about his children? He really is concerned about their well-being and really does want to help them out and answer their prayers. Or do you think God's just some mean old judge? They just keep bothering me, just keep praying. Fine, here, have your new car or whatever. I need the way God works. But if we take every little thing about every little parable as real, then we have to view God like that, right? And so that's just an example. We can't make the parable work harder than it's meant to work. We can't make the parable teach more than the Lord meant to teach in the parable. Another example is the parable of the talents. In Matthew chapter 25, there's a very interesting statement said in the parable of the talents in Matthew 25 and in verse 26. It says here, "But his Lord answered and said to him," now the Lord here represents Jesus or God, and here's what the Lord said. The Lord said, "You wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed." Does that sound like God? Someone who's unjust? Reaping where he hasn't sown? Gathering where he hasn't scattered seed? No. And so you see, that little detail in the parable was just a filler. It's just an incidental to make the story work. Not to teach a lesson about the true character of God. And so we have to be very careful when we approach the parables. This brings us to our next point before we get into too much detail on this. Regarding the parables, we must define the elements. We must discuss the application, explanations, and then finally, and this is true with any parable, we need to determine the essence of the parable. Not just pick apart every little piece, every little word, every little statement, every little element, and make some kind of great spiritual lesson attached to it. But what's the essence of the parable? There's a point, and notice I said a point, that Jesus wants to make here in this parable. There are other incidental points, I realize that can be made and needs to be made from this parable. But Jesus has a main thrust. What is that main thrust? Well, I believe that if we can determine the essence of this parable by simply looking at the facts, and then we can come to the proper conclusions regarding this parable. And we should be able to especially be successful in this parable, as I said before, because Jesus gave the explanation of this one. He explained it. And first of all, we need to point out that many of the things said in this parable are simply, again, meant to be incidentals and are not intended to teach any particular lessons. Just like Matthew 25, verse 26, as we looked at a moment ago, was not said with the intention of teaching us that God was unfair or unjust in his planting and sowing and reaping. Just like Luke chapter 18, verses 1 to 8, was not intending to portray God as not really caring or being concerned about any of his children. Let's go back to this verse in Matthew 13. This is our parable, verses 28 and 29. "He said to them, an enemy has done this." And by the way, and this may be a valid point many make, that the servants came to him and said, "Lord, did you not sow good seed? And here, why are there tares in the field?" Does that sound like a question common to man? Why is there evil in the world? If God is all good and all he creates is good, where'd the evil come from? And what did the Lord say in this answer? He said, "An enemy has done this." An enemy has done this. I heard a preacher say one time, Satan is a pervert. He is not a creator. Satan never created anything. Satan takes that which is good, that which God created, and perverts it. That's the work of Satan. A good field with good soil and good seed. And what's Satan do? He goes in there and perverts it. He perverted the world, didn't he? I mean, the world as a whole, when God created it, was a good field. He planted Adam and Eve there. They were good seeds. What'd Satan do? He went in there and perverted that. He went in there and tempted Eve to sin. She did. She tempted her husband. He sinned. Satan perverted that. An enemy has done this, he said. But read on. It says, he said to them, an enemy has done this. The servant said to him, do you want us then to go and gather them up? But he said, no, lest while you gather up the tares, you also uproot the wheat with them. Now again, many teach that we should not weed out the evil from the church, or those who believe the field is the world teach that we should not judge others, but both sides miss the point on these verses. The details given in these verses were simply incidentals given to complete the story without meaning to teach a specific lesson. Now, how do I know that? That sounds pretty presumptuous. How do I know this? Because those who teach those lessons from these verses are under the impression that the servants mentioned here represent Christians. See this? It said that the servants came to him. The servants said to him. And so they see that servants and they think, oh, that's the Christians. And they're wrong. They're wrong about that. The servants do not represent the Christians in this story. I don't know what they represent because Jesus didn't tell us what they represent. I don't believe that they're meant to represent anything, really, because Jesus didn't say they represented anything. He told us a lot of things and said what they represented, but he didn't say anything about these servants that were mentioned, didn't say what they represented. But one thing I know for a fact is that the servants do not represent the Christians in this story. You know how I know? Because the Christians are represented by the good seeds, aren't they? Jesus said the good seeds are the sons of the kingdom. And so if the good seeds are representing the Christians, the servants cannot also represent the Christians. And the servants are not the good seeds in the story. You just read it. They're two different things. The Christians are represented by the good seeds. The servants, I don't know who they are, what they are. Doesn't matter. Jesus doesn't tell us. I know who the reapers are. They're the angels. The Lord tells us that. And so we can't go in here and press a point and say, well, the servants here represents the Christians and therefore the Christians shouldn't judge, or therefore the Christians shouldn't practice church discipline, when the fact is the servants don't represent the Christians. The good seeds represent the Christians in this story. And so you see why we have to be careful when we go into a parable and start picking it apart and start trying to teach and bind spiritual lessons from it. We have to be very careful, but that lesson was meant to be taught by the parable. So what's the point of the parable? What is the essence? What is the lesson that we learn? Well, I think in the explanation of the parable, Jesus really focuses on one main issue, and that is the harvest. And a matter of fact, we just sang about the harvest in the song Tony led a moment ago, and some people refer to this as the parable of the harvest, and I think they've got it right there. They've captured the essence of the lesson. I think the main lesson we're to learn here is the lesson about the harvest and what is going to happen at the harvest. Notice the tone of this. Read with me again Jesus' explanation here. Matthew 13, verses 36 to 43. He says here, let's begin in verse 37. He answered and said to them, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. Now he gives his lexicon here. He defines different things. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom. The tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Now he's going to give the main lesson. Look at here in verse 40. He jumps right to the end, doesn't he? Right to the end. He said, therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. Jumped right to the end, didn't he? He's passed over all those other incidentals and just jumped right to the end of the parable. That must have been the main lesson. I believe it was. Read on. He says, verse 41, the Son of Man will send out his angels, there's the reapers, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And then the righteous will shine forth as the son of the kingdom of their father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. And so the main thrust of this parable is clearly to teach the fact of the judgment of the last day, with a particular emphasis on the eternal punishment that will be meted out to those who are not children of God. The essence of this parable seems to be illustrating the reality of eternal punishment in hell. Now today we have Jehovah's Witnesses. And we have so-called Jehovah's Witnesses. We have those who call themselves Christadelphians. And I've learned in the last few years there are several prominent teachers in the Church of Christ who are believing and teaching that eternal punishment in hell is not a reality. They're believing and teaching that the same things that Jehovah's Witness teach, that we're pretty much annihilated. Most of you know a man by the name of Homer Haley, who taught other parts of error in his life. And when he died, his partner in publishing published a book that his family didn't want published. And in that book, he teaches and defends the idea that there is no real existence of a real hell. That it's just not real. And so there are brethren teaching that. But Jesus plainly teaches in this parable that it is a reality. But you say, well now, why would he be so strong on that point? The JWs, the others, they weren't around when Jesus was teaching this parable. So why would Jesus be so strong in teaching a whole parable to emphasize that point? Well, in the first place, don't you think God knew these groups would exist in the future? That's one point to consider. But in the second place, there were plenty of religious people in Jesus' day, including many Jews, who would deny the eternal nature of the soul, thus denying the reality of hell. Remember the Sadducees? Remember them? Acts chapter 23, verse 8. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit. If you deny the resurrection, you've not only denied the hope of heaven, but you've denied eternal punishment in hell. You've denied all of that. And so Jesus is emphasizing the reality of eternal hell here for those who insist on being servants of Satan. Matter of fact, other passages emphasize this point, right? Remember Matthew 25, 46, when he's separating those on the right hand, those on the left, the sheep and the goat, the ones on the right hand are the ones who were full of good works during their life, visiting the sick, helping the needy, those in prison and so forth, clothing those who are naked. And then the ones on the left were the ghosts, and they didn't do these things and failed to do these things when they had the opportunity. And Jesus said these will go into everlasting life, but these will go into eternal punishment. Remember Mark chapter 9 and verses 42 to 44 there? Jesus said, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life maimed rather than having two hands to go to hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. That's a real place. Remember 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 and 9, where Paul pictures Jesus returning from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and on those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. 2 Thessalonians 1, 7 and 9. These shall be punished with everlasting destruction. Look at that. These shall be punished with everlasting destruction. How long does it last? Everlasting. Eternal. A fire that is not quenched. A worm that does not die. The soul doesn't die there. It'll want to, but it never will. And then, of course, Revelation chapter 21 and in verse 8, at the very conclusion of the Bible, it says the cowardly, the unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexual immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. This parable emphasizes the reality of hell. It's just a fact. It emphasizes that. And remember, the explanation is not the parable itself. It's the real explanation. And so it's not symbolic. It's the real lesson. And the explanation, Jesus emphasizes the reality of hell. And what a shame it is that there will be people going there eternally at the last day. So when we consider the wheat and the tares, it's not an easy parable. I mean, it really takes a lot of study to try to get this, and then you may mess it. I may have missed the boat tonight. I don't know. But I think we'll have a clear understanding if we define the elements of the parable. Jesus did that for us. If we will discuss the explanations, there are many out there that people give. Discuss them, look at them, compare them with what Jesus said. And then if we will determine the essence of the parable, that is, the harvest, the separation of the last day,